is a wealth of information in the form of precisely sequenced chemicals that scientists represent with the letters A, C, T, and G, for adenine, cytosine, thymine, and guanine. In a written language, information is communicated by a precise arrangement of letters. In the same way, the instructions necessary to assemble amino acids into proteins are conveyed by the sequences of chemicals arranged along the spine of the DNA. This chemical code has been called the language of life, and it is the most densely packed and elaborately detailed assembly of information in the known universe.
Scientists working on the origin of life, Kenyon realized he had two choices. Either he had to explain where these genetic assembly instructions came from, or he had to explain how proteins could have arisen directly from amino acids without DNA in the primordial oceans. And in the end, he realized he could do neither.
It's an enormous problem how you could get together in one tiny submicroscopic volume of the primitive ocean all of the hundreds of different molecular components you would need in order for a self-replicating cycle to be established. And so my doubts about whether amino acids could order themselves into meaningful biological sequences on their own without pre-existing genetic material being present just reached, I guess for me, the intellectual breaking point sometime near the end of the decade of the 70s.
As Kenyon reevaluated his theory, new biochemical discoveries further weakened his conviction that amino acids could have organized themselves into proteins.
The more I conducted my own studies, including a period of time at NASA Ames Research Center, the more it became apparent that there were multiple difficulties with the chemical evolution account. And further experimental work showed that amino acids do not have the ability to order themselves into any biologically meaningful sequences.
Faced with mounting difficulties in his own theory, and a growing body of scientific data about the importance of DNA, Kenyon was forced to confront the absolute necessity of genetic information.
The more I thought about the enormous problem that all of us who worked on this field had neglected to address, the problem of the origin of genetic information itself, then I really had to reassess my whole position regarding origins.
For Dean Kenyon, a new question became the focus of his search for life's origin. What was the source of the biological information in DNA?
If one could get at the origin of the messages, the encoded messages within the living machinery, then you would really be on to something far more intellectually satisfying than this chemical evolution theory.
Yet Kenyon faced a narrowing set of options, for he realized that as with pure chance, natural selection was also limited in its creative power. By definition, natural selection could not have functioned before the existence of the first living cell, for it can only act upon organisms capable of replicating themselves, cells equipped with DNA that pass on their genetic changes to future generations.
Without DNA, there is no self-replication. But without self-replication, there is no natural selection. So you can't use natural selection to explain the origin of DNA without assuming the existence of the very thing you're trying to explain.
Natural selection, chance, and his own theory of self-organization had all failed to explain the origin of genetic information. Now Kenyon saw only one alternative.
We have not the slightest chance of a chemical evolutionary origin for even the simplest of cells. So the concept of the intelligent design of life was immensely attractive to me and made a great deal of sense, as it very closely matched the multiple discoveries in molecular biology.
In the years since Kenyon's rejection of chemical evolution, science has revealed the details of an entire system of information processing that bears the hallmarks of intelligent design. With computer animation, we can enter the cell to view this remarkable system at work. After entering the heart of the cell, we see the tightly wound strands of DNA, storehouses for the instructions necessary to build every protein in an organism. In a process known as transcription, a molecular machine first unwinds a section of the DNA helix to expose the genetic instructions needed to assemble a specific protein molecule. Another machine then copies these instructions to form a molecule known as messenger RNA. When transcription is complete, the slender RNA strand carries the genetic information through the nuclear pore complex, the gatekeeper for traffic in and out of the cell nucleus. The messenger RNA strand is directed to a two-part molecular factory called a ribosome. After attaching itself securely, the process of translation begins. Inside the ribosome, a molecular assembly line builds a specifically sequenced chain of amino acids. These amino acids are transported from other parts of the cell and then linked into chains often hundreds of units long. Their sequential arrangement determines the type of protein manufactured. When the chain is finished, it is moved from the ribosome to a barrel-shaped machine that helps fold it into the precise shape critical to its function. After the chain is folded into a protein, it is then released and shepherded by another molecular machine to the exact location where it is needed.
This is absolutely mind-boggling to perceive at this scale of size such a finely tuned apparatus, a device that bears the marks of intelligent design and manufacture. And we have the details of an immensely complex molecular realm of genetic information processing. And it's exactly this new realm of molecular genetics where we see the most compelling evidence of design on the Earth.
On the video.
Amazing.
Why was it amazing?
Because something as insignificant as the little thing in our body could take all that and be done.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. How many of these in our body?
We have lots. And how about the graphics? Pretty good, huh? Pretty good. That was done by Illustra Media. They are actually based here in Irvine, I believe. And the organization that gave them the material is the Discovery Institute, which is in Seattle. And they are an intelligent design think tank. And what we're going to cover actually tonight is basically that video, Spell It Out. And I've developed a lot of this material from Stephen Meyer, who is the author of the book back there, The Signature of the, Signature in the Cell. And it's about 500-600 pages. It's a beast. It's pretty easy to read, believe it or not. But he basically collaborated, and he was on that video. He was the younger guy with brown hair at the beginning. And we'll talk about Dean Kenyon, the other guy, maybe next week. But in your handout I gave you, if you recall, we are starting the discussion on biochemistry tonight and specified complexity in the cell. So we're looking at page one of the outline I gave you. And again, if you notice, at the header, at the top, it says premise three, intelligent design is inferred as the most plausible explanation of scientific observations. So I spent the last couple weeks describing what intelligent design is as a theory. We talked about how it's the best explanation of observations, and we infer it amongst other hypotheses that rival it, and we say this one is the best out of all of them for such and such reasons based on this body of evidence. And so the first way we're going to look at intelligent design is through biochemistry and specifically the cell. And then as we get into the cell, we're going to look at DNA and information. What is information? And then next week we're going to look into, well, how could this have arisen? Could it have arisen naturally? Could the prebiotic soup have produced this due to different reactions happening in the chemicals on the early Earth? So we'll get into that next week. The chance, well, we may get into chance tonight, but next week we'll definitely get into that and physical necessity as a theory that shows these things generating on their own. So with that, I'll go ahead and just shut this off because I don't think we need it. Usually there are more lights up here, and I'm not sure how to get those on.
No, those are always off.
They're always off? Oh, okay.
So they don't, because the other overhead screen.
Oh, right, yeah, he always has that for himself, right. Okay, well, hopefully it all works out with the video. So, number one, ID is inferred in biochemistry when observing the specified complexity and irreducible complexity in the cell. So we're going to talk about irreducible complexity later. We're going to talk about specified complexity now. A quote from Richard Dawkins, who is, as you may know, a adamant ID hater, if you will, if I could use that word. He is an outspoken atheist, and he says, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. What's the important word in there? Appearance. Having the appearance, or give the appearance of being designed. Christian de Duve, a leading scientist and naturalist, also not Christian, says, cells are so obviously programmed to develop according to certain lines that the word design almost unavoidably comes to mind. So this is, again, another interesting quote. So you can see that even in the secular community, those who are outspoken against ID and Christianity in general will definitely use the word design when they speak of biochemistry. It's something that just rolls off their lips. There's something about this stuff that gives the appearance of design. Item one there, specified complexity shows intelligent design in the cell. Specified complexity shows intelligent design in the cell. We talked about what specified complexity is last week when we introduced the topic of intelligent design. In 2009, Dr. Stephen Meyer, the Discovery Institute, which I just mentioned up in Seattle, this is sometimes referred to as the hub of the ID movement in Seattle there, wrote Signature in the Cell, where he established a breakthrough and powerful case for design in the cell. And note, again, that this entire discussion, like I just mentioned, is from that book. So none of this stuff is based on my own research. I'm just summarizing. I'm just a communicator of material. I'm not the scholar behind all of these thoughts. So all of this stuff and all of these outlines I give you are other people's stuff that I compile and summarize and reword and package up nicely for you so it flows. So a quick background on DNA. The DNA, I'm not even going to try to pronounce it. Deoxy, thank you. Sometimes it can, sometimes it can't. The DNA molecule is a double helix shape comprised of smaller molecules, which are nucleotide bases. And you could see kind of a photo of that double helix shape on the first page. It doesn't show the molecules, but that's essentially the form of the thing. There are 3 billion links between the chains on one double helix molecule. 3 billion. Sugar phosphate groups form the backbone of the double helix. Okay, so the backbone, if you go back to page 1, is kind of that outer line that goes in and out of the other line. It's the outward line. It's not the in-between ladder lines. That's the sugar phosphate group, if you will. The links are referred to as base pairs, which are the little runs of the ladder, as one chain has a nucleotide that corresponds to the other. So on both sides of that double helix, there is a nucleotide, and then that nucleotide has a hydrogen bond with the other nucleotide on the other side. So DNA is transcribed into RNA. DNA is transcribed into RNA. So it's a transcription process that happens, and then RNA is translated into protein, which we saw there, and that's what I pointed out as the important part, where RNA was translating the amino acids through codons into proteins, eventually forming a protein molecule. The genetic code is comprised of, if you want to think of it as this to help, letters being the nucleotides, words being the codons or triplets, sentences being the genes, paragraphs being the operons, chapters being the chromosomes, books being the living organisms. Okay, like myself or, you know, some simple life. So Richard Dawkins again, he says, physics books may be complicated, but the objects and phenomena that a physics book describes are simpler than a single cell in the body of its author. And the author consists of trillions of those cells, many of them different from each other, organized with intricate architecture and precision engineering into a working machine capable of writing a book. Each nucleus contains a digital coded database, larger in information content than all 30 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica put together. And this figure is for each cell, not all the cells of the body put together. So my first thought is, wow, Richard Dawkins, that's pretty remarkable. So again, this is from Richard Dawkins, a outspoken atheist, critic of ID, and bashes Christianity every chance he can get. So his background is biology, evolutionary biology, not biochemistry, but evolutionary biology. The order of the nucleotides in the sequence form a certain code. Okay, that's very important. If the order was different, the code would be different. The order determines the code. Okay, so depending on the order, you get a different code. So if you move a letter, for instance, In the code, it's going to say something different. Your sentence is going to say something different. Meyer presents the following case. Proteins are workhorses of the cell. They catalyze reactions. They form the structural parts of the molecular machines. And they help copy and process genetic information. And if you go to gym a lot, they make you buff. Nobody even looked up on that one. Okay, so if you go to the gym, you take protein powder, you get buff. Okay, forget it. All right, so to explain proteins, we must explain the complex 3D shape, structure, and specificity. The specific order of the amino acids that are linked together. That's what we're talking about in terms of when we talk about specificity, is the specific order of the amino acids that are linked together. And if they are linked together just right, it will fold right. So it went into, you saw that kind of other contraption, and it kind of started folding, and that's when I was saying now it's being folded into a protein. So if the amino acid chain is in the right sequence, if all the parts line up in the right spots, then when it tries to fold in on itself, it will fold just right. If it is rearranged, it will not fold right. Okay, so if you change the sequence again, it won't fold right. There's some properties in the amino acids themselves that make each link have a certain kind of connection to it. So it could be skewed or, you know, in different ways, and then that skew will produce a certain fold shape. The order of amino acids determines the protein shape. The shape of the protein determines its function. The shape of the protein determines its function. The form will determine the job of the protein. So in architecture, we say function follows form. Form follows function. So if you're going to design a building, you need to know what the function of the building is. Is it a warehouse? Is it a church? Is it a gas station? What sort of function, what sort of operations are going to be happening there? And then the form of the building follows from the function of the building. But this is the reverse. In this case, the form determines the function. So depending on what form that protein is in, will determine the function of that protein, will determine its job, what it goes and does. So you could kind of think of it as maybe personality, for instance, or talent or gift. You know, if Chris is gifted with wood and carpentry and things like that, mechanics and audiovisual, then for some reason his brain is interested in that, he's gifted that way, he can put things together and make things work, then maybe his function, maybe his job would be having to do with using his hands. So I think that describes you pretty well, since you do lots and lots of things, including plumbing in showers at 24-Hour Fitness, where you had a job doing that at one point. That was a funny story you told me. So he's an interesting guy, people. If you want to get to know an interesting guy, talk to Chris. So I'm picking on people just to kind of, this is a little bit boring of a topic, or it could be a little too heavy sometimes, so just trying to keep it light. The shape of the protein determines its function. The form will determine the job of the protein. Proteins can't perform functions unless they fold into stable structures. So it can't do its job unless it's got a stable shape and structure. Now, Francis Crick and his colleague, I think James Watson, I'm not quite sure his first name, were at the forefront of this back in 1953, I believe, is when they were thought to have discovered the DNA molecule and its shape, the double helix. And there were other researchers investigating that same thing at the same time in the United Kingdom. And there's three different groups, but they were the group that discovered it. And so they won the Nobel Prize, and in the last 60 years, you know, have been the most, you know, some of the most famous scientists out there. Whereas the other groups that were just right on the cusp of it got no recognition. And it was said that those other groups, they could have and often did collaborate with, and some of that material maybe they got from those guys. But anyway, Crick and Watson are kind of the big names. If you think about DNA, these two guys are the big guys. Proteins display an information property called sequence specificity. And sequence specificity is this. It's if the function of the whole is determined by the arrangement of the parts. Actually, you just get rid of the word if. The function of the whole is determined by the arrangement of the parts. So the idea here is, again, like sections of a computer code or words in a sentence, if the words in the sentence are arranged correctly, then we get a meaningful code. We understand it. It's got meaning. If the words in a sentence are arranged incorrectly, then we do not get a meaningful code. So sequence specificity has to do with this idea that things have to be in the right order or the whole doesn't work. The parts have to be arranged correctly or the whole doesn't function. So if the amino acids are arranged correctly, then we get functional proteins. If the amino acids are arranged incorrectly, then we get non-functional proteins. Again, if you don't have a right sentence, you can't understand and make out the words. If you do have a right grammatical sentence, then you can make out the words, and it is a meaningful sentence, and it works. So proteins are sequence-specific. That's the idea. Proteins are sequence-specific. So there are three key features in proteins that you need to remember. The shape performs functions. The shape basically will determine the function. The shapes are produced by folded chains of amino acids. And the precise sequencing of amino acids determine the folding and eventually the functioning. Eventually the functioning. Okay. Specificity of arrangement of amino acids is critical to overall biological functioning of the cell. The sequence specificity was derived from a prior specificity, from a prior order. Now, this is where it gets heated, right? How do proteins get their beautiful shape and their function? Through the DNA strand of ordered nucleotides, and the RNA translation that builds a line of amino acids. So I saw when I said this is the important part, that's when the RNA was building that sequence of amino acids. You saw these amino acids coming in, and then the RNA thing was kind of moving, trickling along, and then that thing would attach to it, and then it would build this chain, and outward goes this big chain, right? So that RNA strand came because it came about into that processing chamber because it was transcribed from the DNA strand, which was a bunch of nucleotides, just to give you some terminology to work with. Now, back to J again there. The sequence specificity, the order of those amino acids, the sequence of them, was derived from a prior specificity. So again, where was the prior specificity? It was back in that DNA molecule. The RNA transcribed the DNA. The DNA had an order of nucleotides. So once you get an order of nucleotides, you get it eventually through the RNA process, you get an order of amino acids. And that again determines the protein. So where does that order come from? Where does that order come from? That's the question. Where does the order of the amino acids come from? It comes from the nucleotides order. Where does the nucleotides order come from? What best explains the order and sequence of the nucleotides? Okay, so this is kind of, now I'm getting to where we're going here with this. Digital information is being used to direct mechanical parts and machines. Information is the key. Information is the key. Information in the DNA is what is directing the proteins to be formed in the right way, which causes proteins to function in the cell. So if you think back to Richard Dawkins' statement about all this information in the cell and in the DNA, and one cell could be like the Encyclopedia Britannica. Well, that's very true. People talk about DNA as being a storehouse of information. So just to give you a feel for what that looks like is in, this is kind of cool stuff, in Japan, in 2008, there's a team of researchers that were able to write, like we write to a CD, they were able to write to the DNA molecules themselves information. They were able to write, I think, can't remember what it was, but it was like a sentence or something. And they just kept repeating the sentence. So, you know, probably like 10 words or something. And they wrote it into the DNA, into biochemical nucleotides, basically, ordering them. And it contained that information. Just like in the computer, you have a bunch of zeros, 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 ones, one, ones, and the orders of the zeros and the ones determine everything that happens in the computer. The pixels, the colors, the everything, the calculations. And so, interestingly, Harvard University researchers and Johns Hopkins University researchers last year, around September, were able to not just write into the DNA a sentence, but they were able to write into it an entire book. An entire book, believe it or not. So they thought that that could not have been done because the ordering process, because it's such a tiny, tiny thing, the ordering process was just going to have a bunch of errors. And so what they did was they figured out a way to reduce the errors. So they were able to generate sentences, you know, or a bunch of words together from the book, you know, piece by piece, these groups, and they wrote them in individually. So there'd be less of a chance of an error instead of trying to write the whole book at once. And they were able to do this like in one little cell or something. I mean, just a tiny, tiny amount of DNA strands compared to what's in someone's body, you can get a whole book. You know, so I think they were saying, I can't remember what it was, but you could have something like, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of books written into someone's body or something of that nature. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was a big, big thing. Like, a lot of information. I think they put it in terms of bytes. I have it. I'll give it at the break. But anyway, it's a lot of bytes. It's like, you know, a terabyte. You know, modern computers have like, you know, 200 gigabytes of storage capacity. Well, a terabyte's 1,000 gigabytes. A billion bytes. Yeah, so I think a billion bytes. So so it was like, I can't remember the word. It had an X and then bytes. So not like zillion bytes, but even maybe beyond that. So like a lot of bytes. Anyway, they are now doing this. So Richard Dawkins, when he said that it's like it can hold an Encyclopedia Britannica, you remember that? Like, he's not joking. It really can. Literally hold an Encyclopedia Britannica. It says, each nucleus contains a digital-coded database larger in information content than all 30 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica put together. Each nucleus. So, like, he's not just giving you a hypothetical. Like, literally, they're doing this now. He made that quote years ago. Okay, back to page 5. Again, information now is the key. Information. An Encyclopedia Britannica is a bunch of what? Information. It's written information. It's in a sequence. It's sequence specific. So you have a code, essentially. You have like almost like a dictionary. You have a word and then a bunch of definitions, or an encyclopedia, a bunch of explanations. So again, an Encyclopedia Britannica is a large volume of information, and it's nothing compared to what the storage capacity is for one cell. So information is the key. Now, M, this is the new revolution of molecular biology. Now, I say new, but I'm going back to 1953 till now. So anything from the past 60 years is what I'm talking about in terms of revolution. I'm just kind of being outlandish with that term. The DNA enigma is, where did it come from? Where did it come from? Not where the information resides. Now we know where it resides. We're playing with it. We're writing to it. as if it's a CD-ROM. And it's not what it does or how it does it. Now we know what proteins do, where they come from the DNA strand, so we know kind of what things do and why they do it. But the question now is, where did it come from? The problem of the origin of life is clearly, basically equivalent to the problem of the origin of biological information. Now this quote is from a very, very famous German or Russian biologist, Bernd Olaf Kuipers. And I don't know exactly where he said that or wrote that, but he did. And he's not an ID person. He's a very secular, atheistic sort of mind. He tries to prove that the origin of life came from natural causes. But he gets it. He gets the idea that the origin of life is clearly, basically, equivalent to the problem of the origin of information. Where did the information come from that orders the proteins that make the cell work, that are the initial building blocks of life? It concerns the questions of origins. That's the DNA enigma. That's the issue now, the origins. Where did the precise sequencing that allows the direction of mechanical operations come from? This gets to the question of the origin of life itself. For life, information is necessary for the arrangement of parts. Information is necessary in order to get the parts in a certain order. So proponents of design argue that previously existing meaning is what orders the sequence, as the information in the genetic code existed prior to and outside of the parts of that code, and that information was imposed on those parts by a mind. Now, this is philosopher J.P. Moreland, who has a bachelor's, I believe, in chemistry as well. Any questions at this point before we keep moving? We'll take a break in about 10, 15 minutes. Any questions at this point? Okay. Complexity versus specified complexity. Last week we talked a lot about specified complexity. What is it? What is this idea of something being so improbable that it's beyond the universal probability bound? Do you remember that? And this idea of it being specified, it had a certain sequence, and I talked about the safe, card game, that sort of thing. Well, you can go a lot deeper with that whole idea. So these mathematicians around World War II, this guy Shannon, he was a brilliant mathematician, and he came up with this whole idea of information and how it relates to improbability. And he said it was basically inversely proportional to improbability or uncertainty. So the more uncertainty there is to could be to something, the less information you have. The more uncertainty you have, the more information. Beside the point, the whole thing we can derive from Shannon was that he said that information of this simple sequence, me, which is a structured set of low-level information. So you just get a bunch of, say if you're doing Morse code, it's kind of the same couple, responses on the little trigger there. It's just very simplistic information. As an example, in nature, it's like H2O. You got water and it forms ice crystals and snowflakes. And the internal properties of the entity H2O determines the shape. I would probably say not so much for snowflakes. You could probably take that word out, but definitely for ice crystals. So it has these sorts of features that are inherent in the materials themselves. Okay, that's Shannon information. Leslie Orgel in the 70s, I believe, he had this idea of common information. I'm not sure why he used the word common, but this is the idea of it being highly improbable but specified to perform a function. So this, again, it has to do with this concept of specified complexity. which results in functions. DNA represents something incredibly greater than the information and order seen in H2O, seen in water. The information in the cell is not just Shannon's information, it is Orgel's. So what we're saying here with that is just that it's not simplistic, repeated information, it's highly improbable and it's specified. That's the deal that Orgel brought out when he started theorizing about what information is. What is information? So we'll talk a little bit more about what is information momentarily, but before that, specified complexity in the cell. So the information in the cell is not just complex, which again is improbable, but it is specified, independently patterned to form a function. The information in the cell exhibits specification and complexity. So that's what we're saying, is that when you go into the cell, what kind of information do you see? Do you see Shannon information, just repeating simple statements, a bunch of nucleotides that are arranged in the same order, like all the way down? Or do you see Orgel information, something that is very specified and complex? A lot of information is there as we know information. Books, for instance. Thus, we refer to the information in the cell as specified complexity, or having the quality or property of specified complexity. So information in DNA performs a function. Again, once you have information there, what does it do? Well, because of all those functions that you saw on the video, it basically eventually creates actions in the cell. Information in DNA performs a function. It tells the cell how to arrange the amino acids to build the protein, like we talked about, this chain or link of amino acids. Eventually get to the protein from originally starting at the DNA. Francis Crick, he said this. Again, he was one of the founders or the discoverers of DNA. By information, I mean specification of the amino acid sequence in the protein. So again, secular scientist, not Christian, not ID theorist. And all I've given you so far is what secular scientists have said about information. I'm not I'm not doing a Christian maneuver on you here. I'm just telling you this is what they say information is. And he recognizes as well that DNA has information. By information, I mean specification of the amino acid sequence in the protein. Now, information itself. We could talk about information all night. I didn't want to spend a lot of time on it because we all are in a technological age. We know what information is. We've talked about how it is in the cell's specified complexity. So I'll go quickly through this. In the cell, it is both specified and complex. This is crucial and necessary to explain the origin of life. Dawkins admits that it's very machine-like and it has the appearance of design. Now, this is something Bill Gates has said recently. It's interesting. DNA is like a computer, but much more complex than any computer that we have been able to design. So that's quite a striking statement by Bill Gates. In order to know where information comes from, we must first understand what it really is. But in order to understand what it is, we must learn about how it is transmitted. So I'll talk about that. So transmission of information. So if I'm on one side of the phone and Steve's on the other and he's telling me the Dodgers won, I get excited. That's the transmission of information, right? Information is transmitted across a communication channel, the phone, the telephone. So where we have the source of information on the left, there's some sort of transmission that happens through a communication channel, and then it gets to the recipient of information. So the source of information is Steve. Transmission of information is the phone lines, the cell phone towers, whatever, satellites, the signals, and then I'm the recipient of the information. That's all this is saying. It's pretty basic. Now, mathematician William Dembski, who we talked about last week, who helped us understand the explanatory filter, if you remember that. We talked about chance, physical necessity, and how to make a decision on how one detects design. He says that information can be transmitted in two different ways. One is through communication channels requiring energy transfer, and the other is through communication channels not requiring energy transfer. And again, there's a lot of people, or kind of a newer, I should say, school of thought or field of study just on information theory. People just sit around and think about information. What is it? It's kind of a philosophical field, kind of a neurobiology field. It's just, there's, if you hear the word information theorist, there's a lot of material that's coming out of academia on that. So mathematicians like to put their two cents in too. Now, this is not extremely important, but you may, if you come across, if you research this on your own, you may come across this idea about energy transfer versus information transmission. So energy is transferred, information is transmitted. Energy is transferred, information is transmitted. They're not the same thing. So just because, the point is, just because you have an energy transfer from, say, a chemical to another chemical, or a physical body to another physical body, you have an energy transfer, body moving body, doesn't mean you necessarily have information transmission. And just because you have information transmission doesn't necessarily mean you have energy transfer. This is important when we're talking about the origin of life. The information relationships between source and receiver must be distinguished from the system of causal relationships existing between these points. In other words, just because you have a recipient on one side and then the source of information on the other, it doesn't mean that you have energy transfer between the source of information and the recipient of information. Now, we'll do this part, and then we'll take a break at the bottom of page 11, because we're going to go through this quick. So what is information? What is information? Information has these four parts, or key components, or properties, if you will. One, it's a non-material, non-destructible, it's got these three parts. Non-material, non-destructible, and it's multiply realizable entity. Non-material, non-destructible, multiply realizable. Okay, so what do I mean by multiply realizable? Well, if you think of love or courage or passion or beauty or colors, it could be realized in different objects or actions or events. So it's able to be instantiated in numerous objects or beings simultaneously. Like, I could be giving love in some way over here, Kevin could be giving love in some way, shape, or form over here. And we could be doing it simultaneously at different places. So multiply realizable just means it's a universal that is exemplified in instances all across the universe, possibly happening at the same time. Able to be manifest in different forms or styles. So something that is multiply realizable could come out in different styles. Like, I can celebrate the Lakers hopefully having a great recovery this year and, you know, fulfilling their full potential as the greatest assembled team in sports history with Kobe and Dwight. I mean, it's still my dream. Powell's coming back from injury, and it's like such disappointment. It could manifest in such joy at the end of the season once we get our chemistry together, right? So how could I celebrate that? I could celebrate by going out and getting drunk. I could celebrate by going to church, praising God. I can celebrate by going out for a swim in the ocean in the middle of the night and freeze my butt off, you know, whatever. It could be manifested. My joy could be manifested in different ways. Beethoven's Fifth is in a written form on music sheets, in audio form. There's different media there, and in visual interpretive dance form. So somebody like Mark, who really likes to do interpretive dancing, he could come up here and, yeah, do a dance to Beethoven's Fifth, and we could understand Beethoven's Fifth in a different way. So the information brought out by Beethoven's Fifth through Mark's dancing is, again, realized. It's an information exemplified. Yeah, that would require energy, yes. The representation can be enhanced and thus can communicate the original information better. So say say the digitally enhanced, you know, DVD or something, or movie, was produced on a DVD. So if you take The Wizard of Oz, the original one, and you digitally re-enhance it and you bring it out on a DVD, it's going to look better than the original back in 1950. So it's the same information, isn't it? It's the same Wizard of Oz film, but it's a different media, so it's just brought out and enhanced. So the same is true for information. It could be enhanced. Beethoven's Fifth, played by children's orchestra, for instance, if you go to like a school, little kids' symphony, versus the Pacific Symphony here in Orange County that play at the Segerstrom Hall. So again, same Beethoven's Fifth, it's just realized differently and has a different sound to it. And then, of course, our resurrected bodies and minds. So, for instance, I'm a soul. I'm Jeremy. That's my earthly name. Maybe I'll have a different name in heaven. I don't know. But I'm this soul, right? So I'm in this form right now, but later on my information will be enhanced. It could be realized better later. The representation can be damaged and thus can communicate the original information worse. So the same is true for the improvement of the form of the information, same information but just improved, but it also could be worsened. It could be damaged as time passes. Like books, for instance, deteriorate, and our bodies and brains deteriorate as well. So this is just a little background on information, a little background on DNA, a little background on proteins in the cell. And it's important that we kind of get familiar with these terms and how things work and why we're talking about information and storage capacity and that stuff. Because when we get to the question of origins, when we're Christians trying to explain how we originated here, and we talk to someone who doesn't think like we do, we need to understand how they think, too. We need to understand, well, why are you talking about, you know, these processes in the cell like that? What the heck do you even mean, nucleotide, you know? So the whole idea of this conversation was to just get our feet wet in this discussion. So then we get to the question again of origins. Where does this information come from originally? We have two choices at the end of the day. We have matter produces it or mind. And in matter, you have chance and physical necessity, which are, again, what we've talked about the last 2 weeks in the introduction with the explanatory filter and the two options. Or you have mind. And that mind, again, could be human, alien, or divine. So there could have been some superhuman intellect of eternity, you know, 3 billion years ago that created the cell, which doesn't make sense because he's got cells. Or an alien, for instance. He could have brought it here. He could have, you know, brought some stuff here and created the cell and nucleotides and put them all together and made it work, or a divine mind. So those are basically your two options, and from those two options, you get a couple more options. Any questions at this point? If not, we'll take a break. But do you have any questions? Because I can answer them now, or we could talk at the break. Okay, why don't we take a 5-minute break and come back? Thank you. Idea if that's on or not. I heard the sound, but do you see, Randall, if there's a red dot at the top?
Sure. Yeah, there's a red dot.
Cool, thanks. So amino acids floating around, nucleotides, sugar, phosphate. This is the DNA double helix strand. And the sequence specific, that whole concept has to do with the arrangement of these things, these nucleotides. So the nucleotides are labeled AGCT or some, you know, flow of this could be G, T, C, A, whatever. And there's a different sequence of these letters, if you will. There's not actual letters, they're just little bits of material called nucleotides. And in between the nucleotides, there's a little hydrogen bond that occurs this way, and there's a little a harder bond that occurs this way to the backbone. And what happens is when the RNA comes, it comes and breaks those hydrogen bonds in the middle, and it opens up the DNA strand. And the RNA codons come in and read the DNA nucleotides. And then they take that information after it's transcribed, and they bring it over to this, you saw this kind of weird chamber that opened up, so we'll just call it that. So the RNA comes, and it's its own strand, and then it kind of, so what happens is these amino acids come in here individually, and they form another strand. They get linked together. So we'll say it's linked, a link. And that eventually goes and gets folded amino acid link. And then once you get that folding, you basically get a protein shape that's weird, like that. Clear as mud? And so the idea, again, is the fold determines the function. And the folding is based on the sequence of the amino acids. And the sequence of the amino acids is based on how the RNA transcribed the original DNA when it unraveled it and broke these little hydrogen bonds and read the sequence of the order of the nucleotides. So if these nucleotides were in a different order, then it would create a different RNA reading, then it would create a different amino acid sequencing, and then it would create a different protein. So the information is here. The information could be different. You could have a different arrangement of the nucleotides, a different sequence, a different order. It could have been otherwise. And for various life forms, it is different. And it changes based on what part of the body you're in. So does that help? Protein over here. Yeah. This is for the people on YouTube. Good one. I'm not going to go there. I don't know. They're not, I don't know. I haven't researched carbohydrates, but they give you energy somehow, some way. I know that. But eat the carbs before you work out, drink the protein after. That's all I know. Okay, chance. Page 12. How did this all originate? So this is the big question, right? Question of origins. Where did the information, the sequence of the nucleotides, originate? Well, there's lots of views, but let's start talking about a little bit of them, some of them. Consider the alleged prebiotic soup of the early Earth. Let's say there was such a prebiotic soup on the early Earth. It's been a subject of controversy lately by both secular and Christian scientists. Dawkins and other naturalists argue that, though it is improbable, eventually rich molecules would have arisen in this prebiotic soup on the early Earth. The formation of the first cell is difficult to understand, and determining what life is and isn't is also challenging. So some naturalists will try to say, well, what is life? You know, you Christians talk about how it's hard for life to form out of nothing, or out of a bunch of chemicals. But what is life? What are you calling life? So then what they do is they say, well, here's some criteria that we think life forms have: nutrition, respiration, growth, excretion, responsiveness, and reproduction. They say that if something is alive, it's going to do or have these certain properties to it. But non-living organisms can exhibit at least one of these, and living organisms do not necessarily exhibit all of these. So in general, there's no single watertight criterion by which one can judge whether something is living or not. So the naturalists try to argue this, and they say, well, it's easy if you just relax your criteria a little bit. Lower your criteria, and you'll get something, you'll be able to see a gradual transition from a bunch of chemicals in a prebiotic soup to the first cell, okay? Or a one-celled life form. In the very distant past, this is the way they approach it, in the very distant past, in the primordial slime, the non-living materials developed themselves into primitive life forms, like viruses and bacteria, bearing one of the criterion above. So it could have been just something that reproduced or something that was responsive. It had one of those criteria. Then, after millions of years have passed, the primitive life forms developed into something bearing more of the criteria. So then it had not just reproduction, but it had growth. And then maybe later it had respiration. And then maybe later it had nutrition. Okay? And then, so the transition from living to non-living is vague, as the stages are indistinguishable. The transition is long, and the criteria is indistinguishable. So eventually we get a cell. Now, this process, they try to say, has been backed up by experiment. And so since 1953, Stanley Miller, he did his famous experiment when he had a bunch of glass tubes that he, or one glass tube, for instance, that he had, and it had, he put a bunch of gases in it, ammonia, hydrogen, methane, and some other stuff. And then he put all these gases in there to simulate the atmospheric conditions of the early Earth. And then he sent electric shocks through the glass bulb and into the gases, and over a couple days or so, he saw the formation of amino acids on the walls of the inside of the glass. So this was hailed as a triumphant experiment showing that you can get life from just a bunch of chemicals. And it simulated, allegedly, the conditions of the early Earth. Now, this happened, I believe, the same year as Crick and Watson discovered the DNA shape. So that's that little conversation there. Then Sidney Fox later on showed that from the amino acids that you can get from this bunch of atmospheric gases, you could eventually get polypeptides, which are basically primitive forms of protein. And they formed on the clay surfaces of the Earth after the evaporations of water with amino acids. So the idea was to simulate conditions of the early Earth where you have a bare Earth surface, and then you have water from, say, the ocean crashing into it, and you have these amino acids sitting there on that clay back, 4 billion years ago. And then the coming and going of the waves and the amino acids eventually would have come together and form these polypeptides based on just naturalistic processes of the sun and the waves and just the moving of the chemicals around. And this is kind of the story the naturalists put together. Now, the reason why I say story, you could say theory, is because they should admit that. I just was reading my biology textbook from college. I didn't bring it with me, but there's a good quote in there, actually. I should open my computer and read it to you, but it basically says something like, we don't really know. Okay, after they talk about these two experiments, Miller and Fox from like the 50s, they say, well, all we've done so far is shown a representative example of what could have taken place on the early Earth. But this is leaps and bounds more primitive than the formation of the first cell or the formation of a first life. to get to that stage, it's a huge gap between, you know, amino acids and polypeptides to the formation of the first life. So, so it says something like, we recognize that, but and how did that actually happen? We don't really know. Literally, it says we don't really know. But we have some ideas. It's kind of the gist of this this quote in my biology textbook from college. And then it goes on to share a little bit about this guy Opiron and some other views and other tests that have taken place over the last 50 years. Now, what these tests do and what the tests even of the last few years have done is to try to show that these experiments show representative conditions of the early Earth and how we can get the formation of the first cell or proteins from just chemical interactions, naturalistic processes. And so again, you don't need an intelligent designer, you don't need a creator, you don't need this Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve. You just get a bunch of natural processes to originate the cell, and then the theory of evolution kicks in and takes us to where we are today. So once the naturalist can produce this kind of a first cell or first life or proteins, then they feel like they've got a good foundation for natural selection and random mutations to take over. But this is the sticking point for the naturalist. This is the area where their views are weakest. Because natural selection and evolution, that whole theory, doesn't address origin of life. It has to do with reproduction. It starts from something that starts to reproduce. Then you get these variations in the DNA strand or the nucleotide sequence. And that's what gives rise to random mutations. But again, the theory of evolution doesn't really address origins. It just Darwin did it, and it's not within its scope. It doesn't do that. So how does the naturalist explain the rise of the first life or the origin of the cell? They do so by chance. Chance reactions with these chemical interactions in the early Earth's primitive atmosphere with these weird gases and weird clayey surfaces. That's kind of the in summary what's happening here. Now, I've done my best to produce the best research I can using secular scientist stuff, and now I'm doing my best to interpret that stuff. So we're going to look at chance. How is this a good hypothesis? How does the Christian make sense of this? So regarding Miller's experiment, the gases used in his experiment in 1953 are not representative of the early Earth's atmosphere. In the last 60 years, we realized that, and the other gases, including oxygen, were also present, which would have oxidized chemicals and amino acids in a harsh atmosphere. So later on, we've realized that oxygen was actually present in the early Earth's atmosphere, and that would have created harsh conditions for these amino acids to have formed. So those gases that Miller used were actually not present. There were other gases present, and maybe a few of those, or maybe one of those that he used was also, and not all of them combined. Walter Bradley from Texas A&M University established that the early Earth's conditions would have been hostile to forming the biological building blocks of life, causing degradation and failure. So amino acids wouldn't have been able to form and bond because the conditions would have been tremendously hostile to those things. And Miller's experiment has been repeated and tweaked over the years. Many researchers have had to remove negative chemicals that formed, as these would have just reacted with the biologically relevant compounds, forming an insoluble sludge. So what I'm saying there is that over the years, they've done Miller's experiments, but taken out certain gases and put other ones in. So you still have a chamber of gases, and you're still sending an electric shock through them to simulate early Earth conditions. That lightning would have come as the electric shock, and and hit the primordial ocean and cause these things to react with that energy. But what researchers have done is in those subsequent experiments with those different gases, they've actually taken out the harmful negative chemicals out of the bulb and let the thing continue, because the harmful negative chemicals would have caused degradation and failure to the amino acids. So they've been kind of a... they've interjected human response, and so it's not an actual or a good representation of the early conditions of the Earth, because they're doing something that is not what naturally they're saying has taken place. They're going in and interfering with the experiment. And another thing that is also not true of the early Earth conditions is the UV light that would have hit these early chemicals on the surface of the Earth, the clay, if you will. So in their experiments, they've used a certain type of wavelength of UV light, and they used short wavelength. And the reasons why they didn't use long UV wavelength is it would degrade the amino acids. So again, they've arbitrarily said, we can only shine short wave UV light on this thing because the long wave one would damage the amino acid. And so, again, what we've realized over the last several years is that the early Earth's conditions would have had both shortwave and longwave UV light. And so, again, it's not representative of the early Earth's conditions. So in these two cases, researchers are interfering to make the process work. Now, regarding Sidney Fox's experiment, the primitive early Earth's prebiotic ocean is now thought to be not nitrogen-rich. The nitrogen content in such a prebiotic soup was less than 0.015%. So this has led Brooks to conclude that there never was any substantial amount of primitive soup on the Earth. If such a soup ever existed, it was only for a brief period of time. And if no such environment ever existed, then whatever specificity the chance hypothesis might have once had was now lost. Most origin of life researchers recognize that even if there had been a favorable prebiotic soup, many destructive chemical processes would have necessarily been at work at the same time. So even if you have the prebiotic soup, you still have a bunch of negative chemical processes that form this insoluble sludge. That quote was by Stephen Meyer there, referenced at the bottom. But set that aside. Set all of that aside. That whole conversation, and just say, okay, instead of debating proteins forming on clayey surfaces, and instead of debating gases and bulbs and electricity shocks, let's not even go there. Even though they use those experiments in their examples, we can respond to that. And again, these experiments are happening all the time. I just saw something today about how they've said that here's some research done by this guy in this university. It says this is how the first DNA strand came about, or the sequence specificity came about. So this research is happening all the time. But and no one could keep up with it all. But from what we understand by going to their go-to treasured experiments, they're faulty. So then we have to look at the research that happens over time. So again, this is the stuff in the textbooks that they teach, the freshmen. But what we really need to pay attention to is all the journal articles that come out from every university in the world, and look at each of those, as the years pass, and understand how they are saying that this could have taken place by natural causes. Well, Stephen Meyer's done that in his book, and it came out in 2009. So it's pretty... It's the most recent book that has a lot of this stuff, all those journal articles, and he's already responded to them. Another source you could look at is Reasons to Believe, Dr. Fuzz Rana. He's done a tremendous amount of work in his book, The Origins of the Cell. It's a great storehouse of information, looking at all these journal articles that have come out over the years, and responses to them, showing how they're approaching the data with this sort of perspective, and that doesn't work, and whatever. So there's just an ocean of information out there, but from what we see in the main body of literature, this is what I'm giving you in terms of this primordial slime and amino acids formation and how they show naturalistic causes produced it. Was there a question? Fuzz Rana, F-U-Z, last name Rana, R-N-A, and he's brilliant. Him and Stephen Meyer are probably the go-to guys for talking about DNA and origins of life. Okay, so set all that aside about how this stuff they explain came to be. Let's see if the chance hypothesis. Yes, Steve. Yeah.
So the same situation when we talk about evolution doesn't address origins.
Yeah.
So is chance sort of like that same thing? They're God of the gaps.
God of the chance.
Kind of similar?
Yeah. Kind of. I mean, yeah, I would say God of the... You could say...
Could you say the same thing?
Yes. Yeah, I would say that. I mean, we're using this term loosely like they are. So it's a chance hypothesis. We're saying it's a design hypothesis, but they're kind of name-calling when they call it God of the Gaps. That's what they intend to do with that statement. So we could name-call back God of Chance. You know, it's just the same kind of child game, but whatever. Okay, so chance. So now we're talking about chance. Can chance produce these great, amazing features of the cell? According to Richard Dawkins, again, our favorite secular atheist, measuring the statistical improbability of a suggestion is the right way to go about assessing its believability. So last week we talked a lot about statistics, didn't we? I introduced that concept because now we're actually going to hash that out and see how it relates to the cell. So if you loved that stuff last week, well, here it is again. How fun. So what is the probability that a single functional protein in one cell, in just one cell, would have arisen? Okay, so what's the probability that one single functioning protein, again, the protein down here, its form determines its function, remember? If we have a now, again, this process produces a bunch of proteins. Some of them are non-functional, but some of them are functional. What is the probability that chance alone, by a bunch of chemicals interacting and doing all this stuff, could you get a functional protein in one cell? One in one, okay? Since amino acids form proteins, we consider them to make this calculation. So note that changing one amino acid at one site can result in a loss of protein function as the sequence chain. What changed? What do I mean by that? So one site, so here's a site on the DNA strand, that's a site, and then the RNA copies it, and then you get a bunch of amino acids and they come in here, and that copied deal will come in here and change the sequence. So if it's copied wrong, or if the G and the C are switched, something doesn't make sense, then this amino acid comes and it could change the whole protein formation. If you change one thing, it could have an effect on the protein being functional. Considering the probability of 150 long amino acid chain, which is a rather small length, to form a single functional protein by random interactions. So we're going to consider just 150 sites, just 150, even though this thing is super, super long, just 150. Now, the probability of incorporating only one peptide bond is P equals one chance in 10 to the 45th power. That's the probability of incorporating only one peptide bond. The probability of incorporating only left-hand amino acids is P equals one chance in 10 to the 45th power. So left-hand amino acids is, again, another one chance in 10 to the 45th power. So very, very small chances. Very small chances. Left hand. So amino acids are either right hand or left hand. And in order to form a protein, you have to have a bunch of left-handed amino acids. And they have to all be left-handed. You can't have one right-hand amino acid in there. Okay? So the probability of incorporating only left-hand amino acids, which is what you need for a functional protein, is 1 chance in 10 to the 45th power. That's very, very small. Again, 10 to the 45th power. Probability of achieving functional amino acid sequencing, just the sequence of these things alone, the order, you know, the words in the sentence, letters in the sentence. Okay, the sequencing for functional proteins and information-rich DNA molecules among all the possible combinations of amino acids, P equals 1 chance in 10 to the 74th power. Okay, 10 to the 74th. Now, you need all these three things to get a functional protein. The probability of achieving one functional protein comprised of 150 amino acid chain is P equals 1 chance in 10 to the 45th times 10 to the 45th times 10 to the 74th equals 1 chance in 10 to the 164th power. That is the probability of achieving this one functional protein, one of them, one, just one. That is a very small probability to get that based on all the different variables and conditions that could take place here. Tons of different conditions and variables. Just one protein in one cell. Okay, that's a very, very low probability. When I punch this into my engineering calculator that I use at my work to do a professional engineering job for the biggest engineering company in the world, the calculator does not even calculate it. It tells me it's beyond its capacity. Okay? Now, to give you a sense of scale of what this number means, 10 to the 164th power, because there are only 10 to the 80th power elementary particles in the universe, which is protons, neutrons, electrons, that sort of stuff, the odds of us finding a specifically marked particle is 10 to the 80th power. So if I told Kevin to go out there in space and find this particle that I marked with a red, you know, cross, go find that thing, man. It's out there somewhere. I'm not going to tell you where. Just have fun, you know. And he goes and starts looking, and he's got 10 to the 80th elementary particles to go look at before, you know, that he could choose from in his investigation. That's all the stars, that's all the planets, all the matter and dust everywhere. So he's got a lot of searching to do. 10 to the 80th is 80 zeros after the 10. That's a huge number. Just to give you a sense, a billion is 12 zeros after the number. Oh, that's a billion. Trillion is 15 zeros. So 10 to the 80th is the number of elementary particles in the whole universe. So it's, just to give you a sense, that's 80 orders of magnitude bigger is 10 to the 164th power just to get one protein in one cell, just out of all the variables and conditions here. Now, the first sentence up there on page 18, that is, the chance of achieving a single function protein is trillion, 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 7 trillions times smaller than finding a specifically marked particle in the universe. Okay, so it's extremely improbable that we're going to get a functional protein in, with all these variables. Now remember that the probabilistic resources that we talked about last week, we talked about specificational resources, replicational resources, and the number of opportunities. We had that equation, P equals M times N times, I believe, N. Specificational resources, this is not extremely important, but I'm just giving you a sense. Probabilistic resources just means a number of opportunities and stuff I have at my disposal to see about that something occurs. The probabilistic resources of the entire known universe is 10 to the 150th power. Okay? 10 to the 150th power. That is, this is the universal probability bound, beyond which chance cannot be said to have caused it, as it exceeds the possibilities and opportunities for this universe. Okay? So chance cannot be said to have caused it, because it exceeds the universal probability bound. 10 to the 164th is less than 1 chance in 10 to the 164th is less than 1 chance in 10 to the 150th. So even with all the probabilistic resources at our disposal, we still couldn't even produce this protein if it had to be by chance. Note that this universal probability bound is generous as other calculations by non-ID theorists consider it to be less, at 10 to the 120th power. And Meyer uses the universal probability bound of 10 to the 140th. So Dembski uses 10 to the 150th. That's pretty generous. Meyer uses 10 to the 140th, but other non-ID scientists and theorists use 10 to the 120th. So let's use 10 to the 140th, just to keep going here. The difference is 10 to the 164th power, again, that's one chance that we can get one of these functional proteins, divided by 10 to the 140th power, gives us 10 to the 24th power. Now, what I'm saying here is that if you combine all the probabilistic resources of the entire known universe, every event that can happen from the beginning of time till now in terms of particle interactions, you still have 10 to the 24th, one chance in 10 to the 24th power that this occurs. Or it's a small chance, one chance in that. So even with all the probabilistic resources of the known universe, you still have extremely low chances, 10 to the 24th power, that that could occur. If you give this everything the universe got, you still have that improbability, 10 to the 24th. So just to give you a couple quotes here, let's read this first one. When combining this insight with a number of factors, of other factors that are relevant to computing the probability of generating a single protein by chance, you come to this startling result. If every event from the beginning of the universe till now was designated to searching for one of these functional combinations, among all the possibilities, you would not have time to search more than about a trillion, trillionth, 10 to the 24th, of all the possibilities. And again, he gives us a quote talking about the prebiotic soup and how you still, even with that, as if the prebiotic soup was now, you know, like 4 billion years later, you still have 10 to the 24th power of a chance. So it's pretty ridiculous. So again, this statement there on the next item is saying the same thing, and that little line is one in a trillion trillion. Thus, it is not rational to infer chance as a hypothesis when considering the formation of the first proteins on the early Earth. It is not rational to infer chance as a hypothesis when considering the formation of the first proteins on the early Earth. Now, let's ask, can chance alone find the functional sequences of proteins for one entire cell? So we just talked about, can chance find one functional protein? Well, there's a lot of proteins in the cell. The minimum amount of proteins for the smallest life form, say a parasite, is 250 proteins. You have to have 250 proteins. So we just found one. That was the chance of finding one, 10 to the 164th power. What is the chance of the whole cell forming? Okay, let's say 250 proteins is what we need for the minimally complex life form. Can chance alone find the functional sequences of proteins for this one entire cell? And again, 250 proteins are required. So you have all this stuff I just described, 10 to the 164 power to get this one protein. So we need 250 of these things to form just to get a parasite, which is basically something that relies on other life forms for its existence. In order to get 250 functional proteins in the same cell, the same probabilities would be used for the one cell, but 250 times. In calculating probabilities, this would require the 10 to the 164th power to be multiplied by itself 250 times, because you need 250 of them. So that's probability equals one chance in 10 to the 164th times 10 to the 164th times 10 to the 164th. Okay, I'm not going to say all that. And you keep repeating that term, times 10 to the 164th power, and you keep repeating it 250 times. You get 250 of these terms in the equation. So thus, P equals, to get one cell, one parasite cell, 250 proteins long, is P equals 10 to the 41,000th power. 10 to the 41,000th power is the exponent, 41,000. This is incredibly, astonishingly, astronomically low probability of chance producing a single cell. That is very low. Steve.
So how would Yahweh respond to this? Would he agree with
this? Yeah, so... Yeah, so Dawkins says, well, naturalism doesn't rely on chance alone. So the next item, exactly to your point, scientists started grappling with these improbabilities and realized that it was vastly more improbable that chance could get the job done, finding the right functional combination, so they began to reject it and look for other approaches to the origin of life. So basically, most scientists, researchers do not say that these things came about purely by chance. A bunch of random particles doing a bunch of random things. They would say that there's something else that is added to needs to be added to the equation for the naturalistic processes to produce the first proteins and first cell. And the scientific community does not consider the chance hypothesis to be adequate. And I'm not making this up. I mean, I'm not just trying to prove a point here. That this is nobody in the academic spheres would postulate that chance alone produced the first cell. Despite the experiments that show that little steps along the way from the first amino acids to the polypeptides and this, the Miller and the Fox experiment and all these other guys' experiments, all these experiments, they still don't say chance did it at all. But Darwinian approach doesn't rely on chance alone. So again, it's coupled with this idea of natural selection and random mutations. Both together, you have kind of a chance and a necessity acting at the same time. It's this joint force, if you will, that produces this theory of evolution. In a recent debate, Dawkins declared that chance alone is not what Darwin proposed, nor is it the only part of the theory of evolution. So your question was very timely, Steve. So gold star for you. And what we'll do here is we'll finish this by talking about... Well, let's see. I'll go down to... let's just... Can we go for 5 more minutes or no? Does anybody feel like they're going to fall apart? Randall, it's okay. 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 If you guys want, we could go 5 more minutes. If you don't want to, that's fine. Okay. All right. And then we can finish this thought that you brought up, Steve. Darwinism joins random variations, mutations, as chance events, and the law with the law-like properties of the process known as natural selection. Okay, so early on, scientists invoked this conjoining of random mutations and chance with natural selection to overcome the great improbabilities to the origin of information. But with prebiotic natural selection, we have the logical fallacy of begging the question. We are trying to answer the question of how life originates. Now again, if you remember, natural selection has to do with something changing as it reproduces. Through random variations in the genome, in the different... children, if you will, that are formed, offspring, then you get mutations, and natural selection is the force, the physical necessity, if you will, that creates the survival of the fittest sort of an environment. What is this theory based on? What is this? It's foundation. It's reproduction. It's reproduction. So you have to have something there and something that reproduces for these variations to take place. So if Dawkins or anybody else tries to invoke theory of evolution to explain the origin of the first cell, then they're begging the question. They're introducing something that can't be there. We still get the question of where did that come from? Where did the first cell come from? You can't invoke theory of evolution because it's based on natural selection. It's based on reproduction. And you have to have the thing there initially for it to reproduce. So that's what I'm explaining here. And so you could just turn the page and look at this diagram. In order for any organism to reproduce or self-replicate, it requires information from sequence-specific, information-rich DNA and proteins. So natural selection is a byproduct of self-replication, which is a byproduct of what is necessary for life, sequence-specific DNA and proteins. So that is the foundation for life. Then you get self-replicating life, and then you can get natural selection. Let's suppose natural selection is a valid theory, for instance. Let's just take that for granted and put it in there. Fine, for the sake of argument, okay. Necessary for life, sequence-specific DNA and proteins. This part right here, the sequence specificity of the nucleotides, that's the origin of everything that produces the proteins that make the functioning cell. So if you don't have these things arranged in a certain way, then none of this stuff happens, and nothing in the cell works. So this is where it's at still. So again, they didn't explain it. They're just introducing these replicating ideas and theories of natural selection related to all this stuff, but they're still not explaining this. So it begs the question, what caused the information? So by invoking natural selection, one would be invoking the very thing he is trying to explain in order to explain it. We are invoking natural selection to explain natural selection. That's what they're basically saying. So by biochemist, again, a secular non-Christian person, his name happens to be Christian Deduve, theories of prebiotic natural selection, quote, need information, which implies they have to presuppose what is to be explained in the first place. So again, a secular scientist saying this, that bashes Christianity. Not as bad as Dawkins, but... So prebiotic natural selection is begging the question and should be rejected. RNA also presupposes information to get the primitive molecular replicator going and doesn't account for the origin of information. So a lot of times, research and naturalists, especially on the internet, will point to RNA as being the originator of the information. They say, well, it's not the DNA, it's this RNA, this thing that copies the DNA nucleotide sequence. That's the order, and we could figure out how that gets there because of these things that form that, these chemicals and other biomolecular bits. And they say, well, this is the origin, and we can explain how that got there by natural causes. But in reality, it's not true. You still have to, this is the origin, and this copies that. So that RNA theory has its issues and challenges. Okay, so that's where we'll leave it tonight. Questions before we go? Anything not make sense in this conversation? Okay. Still a chance. Throw the hand up. All right. Okay, well, I hope that helps give you a sense of the dialogue that happens in relation to origin of life and DNA. And I hope it gives you a little bit of interest in DNA itself as a thing of reality. This is something that we have in us all, and every living creature does, and it is quite fascinating. I've never been as fascinated by this. I never really knew why people were fascinated by it until recently when I started preparing some of this stuff. And it is really intriguing. I mean, I've read a lot of stuff in preparing these notes to kind of get them together, and the more I read, the more I'm fascinated by it, because it's such an incredible world in there. When you saw that illustration, that media there, you may have been like, oh my God, I can't believe there's all this stuff happening at that such a small level. And that was my reaction too when I first saw that video about, I don't know, I guess it was 10 years ago, a video like it. And I was like, just fascinated, like, oh, there's molecular machines in there, literal trucks that are transporting things everywhere and dropping stuff off and building things and cranes and stuff like that. And it's just a big honking jungle of a construction zone in there. And so I hope you just are interested and fascinated by it, if nothing else. And maybe this will whet your appetite to read some more books and get into it a little bit more. I really would recommend Fuzz Rana, Origins of the Cell, or Stephen Meyer's Signature in the Cell. All right, let's pray. Dear Lord Jesus, thank you so much for this incredible, incredible creation. We are quite amazed by it, and we're fascinated by what takes place at this molecular level in all of us. And Lord, we don't fully understand it, but we're doing our best. And we pray that you would help reveal your truth to us and give us the mental strength to capture it all and interest to go and learn more about it, because as we do, we learn more about you and how intricate of a designer you really are. And we pray that you would help us this week and keep us from all sorts of suffering, temptation, problems, and other issues that come about in this world that prevent us from knowing you more. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. Thank you.